The Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello and welcome back once again to The Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson, handsome young playwright secretly in love with Mary backstage, and I hope that you will enjoy today's episode. I certainly enjoyed putting it together. The guest today is Randy Skredvet. Randy and I have known each other for a very long time. He knows movies like almost nobody I know knows movies. Although I probably went down to his house to talk about mostly about Laurel and Hardy, who I revere, and who Randy knows more about than almost any living human. We ended up talking about all sorts of things, and as a result, this is actually going to be a two-parter, because we talked and we talked and we talked, and we talked about all sorts of things, went very far afield on all levels of movie comedy and other movie topics, and I just have a great time talking with Randy, and always have. And just get a big kick out of it. And he's a good talker. I didn't feel like editing any of that stuff out to speak of. It doesn't hurt that Randy is a radio guy himself. He has a weekly radio show called Forward Into the Past. And he even told me that he got the blessing of at least one member of the Firesign Theater for that title. And, of course, anybody who loves radio has got to love the Firesign Theater, says me. He concentrates in this radio show every Sunday on music of the 20s and 30s, about which he knows plenty. But he also has radio shows, radio dramas and comedies and all sorts of other peripheral things. And it's a great treat to listen to. And because he's a radio guy, he knows how to talk on the radio. And he has a great voice for it. And I just so much enjoy sitting around and talking with Randy Skredvet. So I'm banking on the fact that you will like it as well, because we're playing half of it this week and half of it next week, and it's just all gold as far as I'm concerned. Now, this has been a great week for me here in Lake Wobegon of Los Angeles, because I know people who don't live in Los Angeles who often deride the place and talk about how horrible it is, and perhaps some of the criticisms are well-founded. The traffic could be better. Maybe one or two more mini malls than you would like in the perfect world. Although, to be fair, almost every one of these mini malls has a donut shop, so the good comes with the bad. But when it comes to watching movies, when it comes to venues for watching good prints, I'm talking 35mm prints or 70mm prints or silent films with live musical accompaniment from pianos all the way up to full orchestras, there is no place on earth, and I am guaranteeing you this, there is no place on earth that has the variety of venues as Los Angeles. This is a movie watcher's paradise, and for whatever it may lack on other levels, and I'm not necessarily admitting that it does, but in case you don't particularly like it for other reasons, there is no way you can deny that this is the greatest movie town in the world. And I've got a couple of great experiences, one last week and one coming up this next week. This past weekend, I just was at a conference called The Real Thing, which is an annual event put on by archivists and people who work in film restoration, and they give a lot of lectures and presentations, some of which were fascinating, some of which I, to be fair, I just had lunch, but dozed through. But they also showed brand new restorations of James Whale's The Invisible Man, Howard Hawks's eye-popping Technicolor Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and the Italian film Investigation of a Citizen Above Suspicion, which was the Academy Award winner as Best Foreign Film in 1972, and which has just been restored, and it was a corker. So we really saw some terrific stuff. But next week, starting on Thursday night, Labor Day weekend, 2012, is CineCon. And I look forward to CineCon more than almost any other annual event. I think the only other movie event that I look forward to as much is Randy Haberkamp's A Century Ago program. And when we get closer to that, which is normally in November or December, we will definitely be talking about that. I think we'll be talking about it with Randy Haberkamp himself. So stay tuned. But in this case, we want to talk about CineCon. CineCon has been going on, I believe this is the 48th annual CineCon. Started out for silent movie collectors, 8mm and 16mm collectors, to just get together and show fun stuff to each other. And little by little, it's expanded so that now we see primarily 35mm prints from all the world's great archives. All the silent films are shown with live musical accompaniment. We see movies from the 30s and 40s. Now, I'm not saying I'm the world's greatest film historian, not by a long shot, but I know my stuff pretty well. And every year, I'm saying every year at CineCon, there's at least half the program is made up of things that I've never even heard of, much less never seen. And that, to me, is the coolest thing in the world, to just sit there in a movie theater, the curtains opening up, and you thinking, what in the world is coming up now? And having no idea what it's going to be, and having something unfold before you. Not saying that everything they show is a masterpiece. Not everything they show is even good. But I've never been sorry I saw anything there, and there have been some things that have just been virtually life-changing, and it's always been great fun. You can still get tickets to go, and if you live anywhere in the area, I urge you to go. You'll never see prints as beautiful as this for this many films over the long Labor Day weekend. More films than you can sit through unless you just are a masochist about just staying inside for four straight days, and that's kind of tempting. But if you are interested in learning more about it, you can go to the website. It's www, that sort of goes without saying, doesn't it, .cinecon.org, and that's cinecon.org. I tried to do it without the www, and it wouldn't come up, so you have to do it. There's some things that you can forego that, but in this case, no. So go to the website, see what's coming up, and if you love silent movies, movies from the 30s and 40s, this is the place to be. It's really going to be something. And I am especially tickled because one of the announced guests is Richard Baer. They're going to be showing some of his shorts that he made in the 40s with his then-wife, Phyllis Coates. And those will be great fun, and I'll look forward to seeing those. But the reason I revere Richard Baer is that he directed every single episode, unless I'm mistaken, and I don't think I am, every single episode of the greatest TV comedy ever made, Green Acres. And just that I will be able to go up and shake his hand. He just turned 99 years old, so I will shake it gently, but I will shake his hand and tell him that he has given me countless hours of joy in this incredibly funny, far more clever, far more surrealistic TV show than many people have ever given it credit for being. It is really one of the greatest shows ever, and his directing is one of the reasons it is so. So this is a very exciting CineCon for me, and I'm looking forward to it, and I'm plugging it with everything I got. I don't get make any money off of CineCon. I will not profit whether you go there or not. I simply want this thing to survive because I love it every single week. As I said, I went down to Randy's, and we talk together well. Randy and I always find things to talk about on the occasions when we get together. And that's, I only say that to explain why, the podcast seems to open in mid sentence, because the truth is, from the minute I walked in the front door, we started talking. We talked while I was unpacking the equipment. We talked while I was setting up the microphones. We talked while I was calibrating the recorder. We talked while we were sitting down at the kitchen table and testing our levels. And so I just picked a pretty good place to start the podcast because we just never stopped talking from the minute we got together. Since he's a radio guy, and since radio is a subject that I love as well, we start off talking about radio. So here's my conversation, part one of my conversation, with the great Randy Skredvet. Radio had an enormous impact on film in many ways, but the first one that I noticed as a child of the 60s is that all of my favorite cartoon characters, especially from the Warner Brothers cartoons, I started realizing had originated in slightly different ways on radio.
Well, a lot of the
Foghorn Leghorn.
Foghorn Leghorn is Mel Blanc's impression of Kenny Delmar as Senator Claghorn. And, of course, a lot of the voice actors who did the cartoon voices were Los Angeles-based radio actors.
Sure.
Elvia Allman, who's Miss Cudd in I Haven't Got a Hat, the legendary very first Porky Pig cartoon. And, you know, she did all sorts of cartoon voices. She was a very busy L.A. radio actress. And, you know, later she was a regular on the Burns and Allen show and the Abbott and Costello and all sorts of things. Because a lot of network radio did not yet emanate from Los Angeles until the advent of Lux Radio Theater and Hollywood Hotel with Luella Parsons, most of what we can hear of her work today from the early 30s would be what she did for cartoons that were based out here. And Arthur Q. Bryan, who did Elmer Fudd, was on the Fibber McGee and Molly show.
Sure.
And on The Great Gildersleeve. So he was a very busy radio actor. And, of course, Mel Blanc had worked primarily, I think, in Seattle radio before coming down here and knocking on the door of the Warner Brothers cartoon department for a solid year before they gave him an audition. And finally, the sound effects editor, who was a guy named Treg Brown, who had formerly been a musician with the Red Nichols Orchestra, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been a guitarist with Red Nichols. he gave Mel a tryout, and, you know, they suddenly realized what they had, and he began working very frequently at Warner's from that point on. But he had been a radio actor before that. So,
Wow. Yeah,
there's definitely a radio and film connection. Another weird thing about radio and film is that there's a lot of silent era actors and actresses who didn't make it in talkies, but they worked out just fine in radio. Now, isn't that weird?
How does that work out?
Yeah, you know, Irene Rich, who had been an actress in silent films, had a radio show called Irene Rich Dramas for years, and Frances X. Bushman, who evidently didn't pan out in talking films, at least, you know, at the very outset of talkies, went to Chicago and became a very prominent radio actor in soap operas.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's...
And he's one that's always confused me because he had a great voice.
Mm-hmm.
He had been a stage actor.
Mm-hmm.
And you thought, he seemed like he's perfectly poised to come over into talking picture.
I could also never understand why Gloria Swanson's Norma Desmond characters didn't make it in talkies because... That's such a great vocal performance in Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah.
And that voice is what you remember, what I remember more than any other aspect of her performance. And you go, her voice is so incredibly expressive. How come she didn't make it in talkies? You know, you'd understand if she sounded like Lena Lamont.
Exactly. Yeah.
But she doesn't. She has a very wonderfully well-modulated voice, and she really knows how to use it. In every inflection counts. You know? So,
yeah, that's one of those things, the suspension of disbelief you have to do in movies. I've seen The Artist a couple of times.
Oh, uh-huh.
Which is much newer as we record this, and it will be by the time this airs. But
probably
I loved
won
it.
Several more awards
by
the time this airs.
Yeah, let's hope. I really enjoyed it, but this guy is so exuberant and so talented that you keep thinking, really? He couldn't have made it in talking pictures?
Yeah.
And then at the end, when you realize he has a thick French accent, you wonder, why didn't they just say that at some point during the movie?
Yeah, he only says with pleasure, but when he says it, it's oui, c'est plaisir.
Yeah, exactly.
You go, it's Chevalier here.
And that would have been a good reason why he was having a hard time with talkies. But
I guess really the only reason he doesn't go into talkies is he's just too proud, you know. And of course, now I kind of liked the idea of him sinking all of his money into his own independent production.
Sure.
Because there were people who did that.
Yeah.
Charles Ray, who was a silent era matinee idol, lost most of his fortune by doing exactly that. He made a feature film that was very expensive, and he paid for it out of his own pocket, and oops, it didn't go anywhere. And so, but he actually was very happy being an extra for the next 20 years or so. And Garson Kanin wrote in a book that he did called Hollywood, he said, one day I was in the commissary at RKO or wherever it was, and he says, and I noticed it was Charles Ray, whom I'd really liked as a kid, you know, and I went over to him and I said, you know, I enjoyed your work very much, and I'd be very happy to write a featured part for you if you would like to perform it. And he said, please don't. He said, I had my time in the limelight, and now I don't have to worry about any carrying the picture or anything like that. I make a nice living just being in the background, and I'm perfectly happy with that. So he was happy to be an extra.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's probably a book to be written about that, isn't there? Just people who ended up in the background. I'm always reminded of that scene in A Star Is Born, the well in A Star Is Born, of course.
When
Is there any other one?
That thing with Judy Garland.
When Norman Maine is out at the racetrack,
uh-huh.
and one of the people who see him have his little meltdown is Marshall Nealon.
Oh, really?
Who actually says, boy, these has-beens give me the creeps. Now, that scene gives me the creeps. Somebody could have given Mickey Nealon that line.
Because he was a very prominent director in the early 20s of Mary Pickford, among others.
And he did not make the transition as a director to sound very well. His first couple of talkies did not do well and weren't very good.
Yeah.
But in his silent work, he's as good as anybody who ever worked. He was really one of the greatest.
Now, in his case, was it just problems with sound or was it other personality problems? Because he was a rather roisterous individual.
I believe that he liked the bottle.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And I think that was the ruin of many a good man, even more so than the House of the Rising
Sun. And he also had a sharp tongue.
Yes.
What was it he said? He said an empty taxi cab pulled up to the curb and Louis B. Mayer got out.
Yeah, that'll make you a favorite of the studios, won't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I remember seeing the Kevin Brownlow documentary, the Hollywood series, and at one point Adela Rogers St. John's, in her wonderful way, she says, well, I think the main problem with Mickey Nealon is that he was Irish. And being 97% Irish myself, I can say that. Yeah. And she just talks about the fact that, yes, you know, the Irish like to drink and they like to fight, and Mickey Nealon liked to do both, and sometimes he liked to disappear in the middle of a production, and so these things kind of contributed to the end of his career. But yeah, it is interesting. If you know to look for some of these people, you find them under the radar all the time, and it is amazing how many actors during the studio system years were making a very, very good living and appearing in 20 or 30 or 40 pictures a year, and you never heard of these people. You know, the Sam Lufkins of the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, B. Western and Laurel and Hardy people know who Sam Lufkin is.
Sure.
But he was never a household name, and yet you look at, you know, his filmography, and there's, you know, 12 or 15 or 20 pictures every year, so he was a busy guy. Or Bess Flowers, you know, who's in hundreds of movies. You know, she's the world's greatest extra, and it's sort of like Where's Waldo? If you watch a lot of 30s and 40s movies, or even going back to the late 20s, and you're consciously looking for Bess Flowers in any crowd scene, most of the time she's there. She's there, you know. So
yeah, it must have been a if you didn't want to be a big movie star,
mm-hmm.
And were just content to do normal parts, supporting parts, and that sort of thing, you can make a pretty good living.
Yeah.
I mean, you could be Wallace Ford instead of Clark Gable, and
in
the long run, Wallace Ford probably had a calmer, happier life.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And just always working.
Yeah.
They were just those guys, you know?
My friend Jordan Young has always loved old character actors.
Sure.
In fact, he wrote a book called Real Characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the first interview he ever did was with Burt Mustin.
Oh, yeah.
Who I think started acting in his late 50s. He was an older gentleman, and I think he lived well into his early 90s and was still very visible, doing a lot of television. And I remember Burt told him, he said, well, he said, this is the only racket where you can work 4 days a month and loaf 26 and still make a good living.
Yeah, that's the path I took in life that was wrong. I work 4 days
time.
A month.
Yeah.
That's
true. Cully,
I could be Burt Mustin.
Yeah, you could be a good supporting actor. My goodness, yeah.
I was just thinking back a while ago to when you and I first met, and I realized with a horrible shock that it was 30 years ago.
Was that when we had lunch with Charlie Barton and
yeah.
Kevin Brownlow? Was
yeah.
that our first encounter ever?
As far as I know, okay. it was.
Okay. I've got a photograph of that somewhere, too.
I do, too. And I was interviewing Charlie Barton for our listeners. Charlie Barton was a prolific director and assistant director, directed 11 Abbott and Costello pictures, a lot of TV, Amos and Andy.
And pretty much the best Abbott and Costello pictures,
yeah.
too.
yeah, he directed Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein and The Time of Their Lives, which, to my mind, are the very best of their series. He also directed Dance with Me, Henry, which is probably the worst. So.
Well, we can't always save every picture.
but
he did the Shaggy Dog for Disney.
Yeah, Toby Tyler.
Toby Tyler. And he did, he did Family Affair, almost the whole run of Amos and Andy.
I think every episode except the pilot.
Okay,
Amos and Andy,
McHale's
yeah.
Navy, Hazel. Just a very prolific television director, primarily comedy.
Yeah.
I remember the one that he didn't like was the Smothers Brothers show, the Angel Show, where Tommy was the angel. He said, get me off of this one. And I think also the Munsters. They had him do a Munsters, and he didn't care for that one.
Yeah.
But, he was a very, very busy director, and he'd started as an assistant, or a prop man, really, at Paramount. He'd been a boy actor in San Francisco.
Yes.
And, in fact, is in a silent film. My friends Jeff and Greg Lindberg somehow found a print of something that he was in when he was about 13 or 14.
Really?
And we screened it for him one day, whatever this film was. But he has quite a Wellman connection.
Well, he has a major Wellman connection. He was in Wings.
Mm-hmm.
He not only did he work on Wings as first prop boy, then assistant director, but he's actually in Wings.
Mm-hmm.
He's the little doughboy that Clara Bow hits with the ambulance. And for all you people who just bought the Blu-ray, and if you haven't, shame on you. You got to go buy it. It's a funny scene, and he was a good actor.
He does a great reaction shot because he's about to get up.
Yeah.
He hasn't really been injured. And then he sees that it's Clara Bow as the nurse who's coming over to him, and he goes, oh, no, I'm not going to miss this. You know, and he conveys all of that, of course, just facially because it's a silent picture, you know. And it's like, oh, no, I'm gonna play injured, you know, so I can have her tender ministrations, you see.
and the title card is Don't Leave Me, Mother.
Oh.
But years later, after he had become a director, which happened in 1934, Wellman asked him to appear in Beaujeste.
Mm-hmm.
And that being the ground zero of my film interest, he looms very large in my life that way. But I interviewed him when I was first starting my Wellman book in my first trip out to California, and then just became very good friends with him.
Yeah.
And as anybody who ever met him, he was just the most lovable guy who ever lived.
Yeah.
And so you and I met, and I met the Lindberghs through that. And I was interviewing him at a convention. It was an organization called the National Film Society.
Oh, yes.
That did conventions out at the Sheraton Universal Hotel.
I remember going to that in 1975 or 6. And just think of the little miracles that could happen if you lived out here in that time. The guest list was Jack Oakey, Patsy Kelly, Ruby Keeler, Joan Blondell, June Allison, both Mrs. Dick Powells were there, and Dick Powell Jr., who looked exactly like his father had in the 1930s. It was really scary. And Eleanor Powell was the greeter. When you walked into the banquet hall, there was this nice lady standing there at the door. And she said, hi, I'm Ellie Powell. And I went, yes, you are. And somewhere I've got Super 8 sound film of Jack Oakey being just totally uninhibited and taking his little adhesive name tag and sticking it on his forehead, and Patsy Kelly being very gruff and Irish and probably had a couple of whiskeys talking about different people in the movie business. But it's just remarkable the people that would show up at these things back then because they were still around. You know?
Oh, when I think back on those things up through the early 80s, I mean, I met Stephen Fetchett.
Oh, really?
I met Lana Turner.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, incredible. I met Elizabeth Taylor at one of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I mean, that night that Elizabeth Taylor was there, Miklos Rosa was there, and Sidney Gilleroff, the hairdresser.
Oh, the hairdresser, sure.
That's why Elizabeth Taylor was there. They were giving him an award. And they were, and they invited all these others. So Betty Garrett was there, and
but not Yul Brynner.
Not Yul Brynner. But there were all these MGM stars there to support him.
Oh, because
for that.
He's on every MGM picture but, ever made. Yeah.
But this was one of the great moments. Esther Williams was sitting at the table, and she kept ordering champagne and charging it to the Film Society.
Oh.
And they were also giving an award to Clarence Ducky Nash.
Oh, really?
And
that's
so
an eclectic group. My
they. So one of the most memorable moments of my life was. I was sitting at the next table from the Gilleroff table, trying to listen in when I could, just to hear Elizabeth Taylor talking to people.
Right.
And they're giving Clarence Ducky Nash this award, and they start and they show a clip from a Donald Duck cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
They may have shown the entire cartoon. I don't recall. Mm-hmm. But while it was on, I hear Esther Williams very loudly say, "Why are they showing that duck?" She says, "I've been in more water than he's ever been in." And Elizabeth Taylor in this stage whisper says, "Shut up, Esther."
Oh, good for Liz.
It was a wonderful moment. It was.
I have a feeling, I never met Elizabeth Taylor, but I just have the feeling that despite all of the glamour and fame and riches that she had, that she was still sort of a down-to-earth gal and probably like the guys on the crew.
Well,
know?
I think so, too. I think she seems to have been pretty normal.
Yeah.
In ways that you wouldn't expect.
Yeah.
And I still remember the very words that she said to me when I was introduced to her. She said, "Hi, Frank."
Uh-huh.
So that was that's really all.
Uh-huh.
But I
you'll never
it.
Forget
yes.
it.
Yes.
So. Yeah, I actually, you know, I've never been starstruck. I mean, I know there are people who just, their knees turn to jelly when they see someone who is a movie actor, but I always actually much preferred interviewing the people who were the guys on the crew. I always felt that they were better interviews and that they actually had a better sense of the overall production because just the very nature of the job of being a movie actor, you're concentrating on your lines and where you have to be and what you have to do in the movie, and when you're not actually up there on the set doing it, you're doing an interview for a fan magazine or you're doing a radio thing. It's all you, and it's just, you know, by nature of your job, you're self-absorbed all the time. And so it's the guys on the crew who see all the actors, and they see the interaction between the actors and the director, and they see everything that's going on the floor out there in the studio or on location. And so because they also tended to be more down-to-earth people, I always thought that they were usually better interviews.
Yeah. That's why I always loved talking to Charlie Barton about his work before he became a director, because he was exactly in that spot when he worked with DeMille and Herbert Brennan and all these, I mean, every major Paramount director, Charlie assisted at some point or another. I never did get a good explanation from him about this whole 1939 thing because he had been directing since 34.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 39, he's in Beaugest as an actor and he acts as assistant director to DeMille on Union Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, what happened there? And he directed a feature at Columbia that year with Brian Donlevy.
Yeah, and didn't he go to Columbia in the 40s? And
yeah, went on to Columbia after that.
Yeah, because he did all those pictures with Ann Miller.
Yeah, and
Reveille with Beverly.
Reveille with Beverly, yeah.
It's a wonderful movie.
Yeah, he made several terrific ones, and God bless him, Joe Besser was in more than one, so that automatically makes any movie good.
Who was another wonderful guy.
He was. And
I got to meet him and Ernie and go to their house many, many times.
Yeah, we had a Three Stooges panel at that same convention one year, and I think the Lindberghs helped me set that up because he was there.
I'm sure they would have because they were effectively functioning as his agent.
Yeah.
in those days.
And Julie Barton was there because she had been in one
Who's still around,
Stooges
by
short.
The way.
Yeah, still is.
Yeah.
Yeah, we stayed in touch for years and years and years, and then have fallen out of touch. So I'm sorry to say.
Yeah.
But we met some great people. We had a character actor panel there one year, and Fritz Feld and Virginia Christine and Anita Garvin, just Yep. Jordan
was very good friends with Fritz Feld and Virginia Christine, and so I got to go up to their place and have lunch one time. And
wow.
She did make a great cup of coffee. She was Mrs. Olson in the old Folgers commercials, for those of you who don't know.
Yeah, if she didn't make good coffee, there would be something wrong. She'd have to lose a contract.
Yeah. And I met Fritz on several occasions when I was doing research on my Laurel and Hardy book. The library of the Motion Picture Academy was up there on the fourth floor of their building. And every once in a while, I'd be there at the desk going through newspaper clippings or something, and the door would just sort of whoosh open, and this little man would sort of run into the room and look around, and I don't know that he actually did that, but darn close, you know. You suddenly knew Fritz Feld was very much in the room. So that happened on a couple of occasions, and then there was another time when I was at the Variety Arts Center in L.A., and they were doing one of their annual magic shows, and the spotlight artist that year was Senior Wences. I wanted to make sure I saw Senior Wences in person while he was still ambulatory. I didn't know he was going to live to be 103, but he was probably only 88 or something at the time, you know. But Fritz Feld was there that night, and of course he was doing all sorts of shtick, you know, running around and just being funny with people. So he was one of these people who was definitely on. He was an actor all the time, but a very nice guy.
Oh, I had Iris Adrian on one of those things, and I remember somebody dropped her off at the hotel, and I was sent out to meet her at there was kind of a circular drive at the Sheraton Universal, and so I was standing out there, she gets out of the car, she's dressed in shocking pink suit.
That sounds like
with
Iris.
A matching turban.
Uh-huh.
And she looks, you know, looking exactly like Iris Adrian ought to look.
Yeah.
And she walks up to me, and I walked up and said, Miss Adrian, I'm Frank Thompson. She was expecting to meet me, and I said, I'm Frank Thompson. And she said, thank God! So we get on the elevator, and there are a couple of kids there, among them Todd Bridges, who was currently on
Different Strokes.
Mm-hmm. And this time, this is the early 80s, he must have been 13 or 14, I would assume. But
at the height of his career.
Yeah. And you know, I recognized him but said nothing, of course. But Iris, lacking the self-censorship gene, stared at him for several moments and then said, are you Michael Jackson?
He probably heard that more than once.
He just politely said, no, ma'am, I'm not.
Yeah, there was not a lot of difference between Iris off camera and on camera.
Not at all.
She was very much that tough, brassy, hard-boiled dame. Jordan and I interviewed her on a couple of occasions, mainly about working in radio with Jack Benny. Because she was kind of a semi-regular on the Benny Show in the early 50s, usually as a waitress. And
she'd
say, what do you want, Mac? You know. But, of course, she's also in Our Relations with Laurel and Hardy. And I remember I fixed her television for her. She had put a little black and white portable on top of her color TV because she couldn't figure out what was wrong with it. And it was just that the horizontal and vertical buttons were both screwed up. So I, you know, just did, oh, here you go, and just fix it. And I'm not sure she was too happy, actually, that I fixed it because it was such an easy, quick fix, you know. But I did it for her. I remember she had lots of cats. There was lots of cats and lots of cat food everywhere. She also said, all these guys who always say they're film historians, they all want to come around and steal my pictures. Fags, all fags. They all want to come around and steal my pictures. I elected not to ask to borrow the great picture she had of herself with Oliver Hardy.
Oh, man.
I would have liked to, but that kind of precluded it. So anyway, but she was fun. She actually, unfortunately, passed away as a result of the Northridge quake.
Really?
Yeah.
Now that I did not know.
She was injured in the Northridge quake and ultimately passed away from her injury. So that's kind of sad.
I didn't realize that. Yeah. That's terrible.
Yeah. But she was a great old gal. She always said that she thought her best work was done in nightclubs. I think it was called Pod and Jerry's. And she was a dancer and singer. And she said, you know, that's where I was really great. She said, I kind of did the same thing over and over again in movies. But, you know, she is a great original, you know.
Yeah.
And I think I also went up there to visit her with John and Larry Gassman, who are radio historians and were very much involved in SPRDVAC, which is the Society for the Preservation and Encouragement of Radio Drama, Variety, and Comedy. And I think I went up with them and we talked about her radio work, which, you know, she did quite a fair amount of in the 40s and 50s.
Sure.
So
And yeah, shows up on TV quite a bit, and especially in the 50s. I mean, she's
lots of Lucy shows.
Yeah, lots of Lucy shows, and on the Benny Show quite a bit.
Yeah. No, I love character actors, and I love the people who were the crew people more so. I haven't really interviewed stars per se ever. You know, I don't.
I like character actors more for some reason. Always have.
Yeah.
Not many of them anymore. Whenever you hear somebody like Dustin Hoffman, for instance, say, mm-hmm. "I'm essentially a character actor," I understand what he's saying.
Yeah.
But he's not one.
No, his name's above the title.
Yeah. And also playing drastically different people from film to film is not, strictly speaking, character acting.
Yeah.
The great thing about the character actors is that they were types. And Franklin Pangborn, is not markedly different from role to role.
Yeah, yeah. They were slotted into a picture because the writer knew what they would bring to the film or to that role.
Yeah.
And, you know, so you get Alan Jenkins because he's going to be Alan Jenkins.
Sure.
You know, you get Franklin Pangborn because you need the guy who's the prissy hotel desk clerk, you know. you get Fritz Feld for the Maitre D. You get Eric Bloor for the ship's doctor. it's not only that they had their own character. It's usually they had the same occupation over and over again in movies.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful film called Romance on the High Seas.
Oh, sure.
Which is Doris Day's first picture outside of a soundie that she made with Les Brown in 1943, and it's directed by Michael Curtiz, who seems to have been able to make any kind of picture really, really well, which is why nobody gives him the time of day anymore, because he did too many things too well, so you can't pigeonhole him.
Drastically underrated director.
Oh, absolutely. He and Mervyn LeRoy,
yeah.
I think, are the two great underrated directors who did every type of picture and did it brilliantly. But Romance on the High Seas is great, not only because Doris Day immediately shows you that she's a brilliant comedian from the word go, it has all these great character comedians in it. And the wonderful thing about it is they all get their little 3 minutes. You know, they don't just show up like in Mad, Mad World, which is a movie I do not like.
No, nor I.
And I don't understand why people are just so over the moon about Mad, Mad World, because I think it's a lot of people being very greedy and very unpleasant for most of it. And most of the cameos are wasted. It's just,
they don't do anything.
They, you know, the Three Stooges just stand
there.
Stand
there,
And you go, well, you know, they're firemen. It wouldn't be too out of the realm of possibility that they could be getting tangled up in the hose and spraying each other with water and doing something funny for 25 seconds, you know?
Something.
That would make all the difference for me in this movie. Yeah. But they literally stand there and don't say a word.
3 hours without a single laugh.
Yeah, exactly. There are more laughs in Stan Freberg's one-minute commercials for that movie than there are in the movie.
Yep.
But anyway, Romance on the High Seas is not like that. Romance on the High Seas has Johnny Burke, who gets to do his drunk routine for a great 2 minutes. And Eric Bloor comes in as the ship's doctor, who turns out to be a real hypochondriac. And he's got his little 2 minutes. And Grady Sutton gets his 2 minutes. And Franklin Pangborn gets his. And Oscar Levant. You know, it's just a feast if you like that type of character actor. Another one, it's a pet film of mine, is Havana Widows.
Oh, yeah.
And
I got that for Christmas.
Oh, you did? Yeah. Oh, good. I love that film. Because it's basically the Warners supporting cast without any stars.
Yeah.
So it stars Glenda Farrell and Joan Blondell, and then it has Guy Kibbe and Frank McHugh and Alan Jenkins and Hobart Cavanaugh, Luis L. Burney, all these great people. And, you know, they all get to do what they do. With lots of snappy dialogue and lots of risque pre-code humor for, you know, an hour and 5 minutes, and then, you know, lickety split, they're out of there, because they knew how to pace movies back then, too.
Oh, yeah, so give me a cast like that, and I care not who writes the nation's laws. Just great.
We do we've done this now for something like 15 years in Long Beach. We have the Long Beach School for Adults Friday Film Forum.
You've had some very distinguished guests there.
Yeah, I think you were down there.
Was I?
Yes.
I don't recall.
Yes, you were. Yes, you were one of our speakers. We've had Miles Kruger. Mm-hmm. We had Ann Savage. We showed Detour, and she came down. We had Betty Garrett, and we showed Take Me Out to the Ball Game. So, yeah, we've had for our little group of, you know, 50 people that show up over and over again, we've had some interesting evenings. And we do, usually during the summertime, we do a pre-code festival.
Oh, great.
So, you know, we'll show a Warren William double feature. We actually showed a Dorothy McHale double feature, probably the first time that's ever happened, where we showed Safe in Hell, the notorious William Wellman pre-code movie, and Office Wife. That was the second feature. So
it's a good one.
Yeah. So we do show things that are a little out of the ordinary there.
Yeah.
So
that not to get off track, but Safe in Hell has been getting a lot of notice recently.
Yeah.
And I think
the New York Times or something?
Yeah, New York Times wrote, and the LA Times mentioned it prominently in an article. You think, how in the world did this happen? I mean, I love the film, and I discovered it in the late 70s when I was first writing the book on Wellman.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've always known it. I mean, for more than two-thirds of my life, I've known this film.
Is it 1932?
31.
31, okay.
And, yeah, it's terrific pre-code stuff and bleak as it can be.
So it took 80 years for the world to catch up to it.
Yeah. But suddenly, out of nowhere, that and then Wings is everywhere. This is some, and then this film forum thing coming up in February that's this big Wellman series has suddenly the world acknowledged that it should be everything that I like.
Yeah, I don't know, but I'm certainly glad that the artist and Hugo have found audiences, and I particularly hope that kids will go to see Hugo and be captivated by Méliès and maybe even become the next generation of film preservationists and historians. It's nice to have a major studio movie where the hero of the piece is a film preservationist.
It really is. And it's such a beautiful film.
Oh, yeah.
It
really is
eye candy. I was so impressed with it, and just from start to finish.
Mm-hmm.
And loved everything about it.
Yeah. I can't even see 3D very well, and I liked it, so.
Yeah. And it was the first 3D film I've seen that really seemed like 3D was essential to the film.
Mm.
Not just something that was added as a gimmick.
They didn't just have the guy with the paddle ball.
Yeah.
From House of Wax. And, bing, bing, bing.
And, of course, I mostly hear people complaining about that. Well, they didn't really do anything, and there was they never threw anything at the audience.
Yeah.
Or mm-hmm. like. Well, maybe that's a good sign that 3D is turning into something.
It's coming of age.
Really.
It's finding itself.
Because that's what's, 3D is, this is the third phase of 3D's attempt to get into the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 50s and in the 80s, it just never was able to get out of the gimmick category and never became, the example I always use is How the West Was Won in Cinerama. If you don't see that film in Cinerama, you simply don't see it.
Uh-huh.
Because watching it on TV or watching a flat print or whatever, I don't know what you're seeing, but you're not seeing that movie.
No.
And when you see it in actual three-panel Cinerama, suddenly you think, oh, yeah.
Yeah, when you see it at the Dome.
Yeah. And it's great.
Which, ironically, had never screened a true Cinerama
process
movie until they brought back How the West Was Won, because when the Cinerama Dome was built, they pretty much jettisoned the actual Cinerama. It's amazing that that ever works.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not surprised that it didn't last any longer than it did, because you have to line up everything horizontally perfectly. You have to line up everything so that the seams don't overlap too much on the three panels of film. You can't have one frame missing from any one of the three, because then you lose synchronization. And the soundtrack is on yet another separate element. So, no wonder they have that reel of Lowell Thomas going, well, I guess they're having problems up there in the projection booth, so let me pull out my wallet and show you my pictures of my grandkids. Still having problems? Okay, well, let me talk about the time I was in Africa. Well, it does work, and when it works, you just go, well, this is a pretty amazing process.
It really is. I mean, it must have just been a total nightmare to make those things, and like you say, to project them is anything that goes wrong throws the whole thing off.
Yeah.
So you can see why it didn't last.
Well, now,
it's just too unwieldy.
What was this new thing they were just making with the Cinerama camera?
Oh, for which I'm one of the stars?
Yes.
Yes.
You're involved in that.
No, I'm not really involved in it. I was just there. They're doing a short film. The guys who have been restoring all the Cinerama films, Dave Strohmeyer, Randy Gitch, and others, who have been restoring these films, had the equipment, had the Cinerama camera, or one of the, I think there's six mm-hmm. originally. Mm-hmm. One was lost in a river.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
During one.
Yeah.
And then, but they had this one, and they had a lot of the other equipment, the lenses and things, and they just thought, hey, what would it be like if we just made a?
It was possible
film?
To actually make something yeah. with the process. Yeah.
So I'm. They're being very close-lipped about what the precise nature of this film is.
Mm-hmm.
By the time this airs, it probably will be more known, but I get the idea that it's kind of a travelogue around Hollywood.
Uh-huh.
That's my sense of it, because the scene we shot was at the Hollywood Heritage Museum.
Okay.
Well, and
that is about as old Hollywood as
it
you can
really
get.
Is. And our scene was simply, they just had maybe 20 of us scattered around the set and around the barn.
Mm.
And my wife and I think we're the only two characters who actually cross all three screens.
Oh.
Because I'm on one side, she's on the other, and when Dave says action, we walk forward, join together as though we've been walking together the whole time, oh. and then walk into the barn.
Well, we'll get to see you
and
go
so,
from panel to panel.
Panel
and see,
to panel.
See the little seam
yes.
moment there
you'll,
when you cross.
You'll see my back, and that's really all.
Oh,
so,
well.
So my star-making moment is still to come. But
well, we'll know whose back it is.
You
we've got your back, Frank.
And it's gonna they're going to be showing in September of 2012,
mm-hmm.
they're going to be showing all seven existing Cinerama Ooh. Films at the Dome.
Oh.
And only three of them, I believe, are in genuine three-panel condition. How the West Was Won, This Is Cinerama, and apparently they're cobbling together a print of Brothers Grimm, which I have never seen.
I haven't either. I remember that Lawrence Welk made a version of the theme song.
Hmm.
And I think it was the flip side of Baby Elephant Walk.
Wow.
From Daktari, or Hatari.
Yes.
Daktari was the TV show.
Yeah.
From Hatari. And because I remember as a little boy having the Dot 45 of that.
Mm-hmm.
and going, The Wonderful World of the Brothers Grimm by Lawrence Welk? What? You know, what a weird song title, you know. That was the name of the song.
There it was.
And so I've always been a little curious about that. But now there was that guy, was he in Ohio? Who
yeah.
had prints that were in vintage rose, which was his nice euphemism for they've faded to the point where there's virtually no color left. They're all pink, but this is all that exists, you know.
Yeah, he that was a guy. He built a Cinerama theater in his house and had people show there. And then a local theater adapted one of their theaters to be able to show Cinerama. Of course, it was much smaller than... Mm. A Cinerama house would
right.
should be, but from the people I know who went there, and I know a friend in Georgia who drove to Ohio, I think twice or maybe three times
wow.
to see these Cinerama films, and I had never saw Cinerama when I was a kid. I grew up in a small town, South Carolina,
mm-hmm.
and there were no Cinerama
yeah.
theaters anywhere, and I don't even think that I was quite aware of what it was.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't until maybe 4 or 5 years ago that when they had finally redone This Is Cinerama and How the West Was Won,
yeah.
that I actually experienced that. And
yeah,
then
well,
once
me,
I
me
did,
too, yeah.
yikes.
Yeah. I've seen How the West Was Won twice, and This Is Cinerama plus the clips that they ran of various other... I guess there was also a Soviet process, which was
yes.
very much like Cinerama, and they showed some clips from some of those films.
Yeah, and Windjammer was made in a process called Cinemiracle,
mm.
which was basically Cinerama.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, what the differences are, I could not tell you, because it seems to be exactly Cinerama, and I think it was just one of those things where somebody just appropriated the
mm-hmm.
idea,
mm-hmm.
and... called it something
Let's
else.
Let's see if we can do that. Yeah.
But that's a pretty interesting film. Kind of weird in its way, but yeah. it's very beautiful to look yeah. at. And
of course, they've done as nice an approximation as they can on DVD of How the West Was Won.
Yeah.
They've got the on Blu-ray, I guess, they've got the Smile Box,
yeah.
which gets the focal range in proper perspective
yeah.
because it was photographed for that curved screen. So when you see it flat, it really isn't quite what it should be, and that's why the seams seem to show up a little more than they should.
And also, the curve of the screen necessitated shooting in unnatural ways. Mm. In other words, you and I are sitting at your kitchen table right now, but if we were being filmed in Cinerama, I would have to look over at your stove.
Right.
While you would have to look over my right shoulder at the wall in order for it to look like we were looking at each other.
Yeah.
And apparently that was incredibly disconcerting for the actors.
Oh, I can imagine.
And sometimes when you – I've seen a 16-millimeter scope print of How the West Was Won, and so it's just flat. Proportionately, it's about right, but it's still just a flat screen, and it looks like people are just avoiding – making eye contact with anybody.
It's very strange. And another problem is that the edge, the right edge of each of the different film strips tends to get discolored, which is why that seam shows up. And they've really done a nice job of cleaning that so that you don't see that discoloration at the edge anymore. So they've done what they can do in the home video realm.
Yeah, I think they're releasing all of them on DVD eventually in Smilebox. Ah. I've seen... two or three of them now at private screenings from the people who are working on them. So we're just seeing it on a screen as big as a living room wall, but no bigger than that. But it's amazing how convincing it is. It's not overpowering like Cinerama should be.
Yeah.
But at least dimensionally it looks right, and you can get a sense of what it's like. You don't get the awesome feeling.
It doesn't quite extend past your peripheral vision the way it does when you're watching it at the Cinerama Dome.
Yeah,
you're really in that movie when you see it there.
Yeah, when I see How the West Was Won, and I went four times over two different showings, over two times it was there. And the last time we sat about row six in the center. And so it was completely in my peripheral vision.
Yeah.
There was no way I could look without seriously turning my head.
Right.
That I couldn't see the picture.
Yeah.
And that seemed to me in some ways to be the ideal way to see it. Like you're completely immersed in it.
Oh, sure. Now I remember seeing it as a little boy, at just a local neighborhood house. So it was a reduction on one 35 millimeter strip. And I remember being so upset at Walter Brennan being such a bad guy, because I knew him from The Real McCoys.
Sure.
And, I knew him as Lucas McCoy, and I was going, that's not the way he should be, because I was, four or something like that at the time. So I was very upset by that movie when I was a little boy, but fortunately I've grown out of that now, so it doesn't bother me anymore. I've seen Walter Brennan as both good guys and bad guys in many a film.
And he's always good at both.
Pretty much, yes. Yeah.
Now that, just to completely go off on a peripheral thing, which I'll bring back. So, but when I was a child, we loved The Real McCoys, and my grandmother would come to our house because she didn't have a TV, and she would watch The Real McCoys. That was the only thing she liked to watch. And they were on this ranch, and it seemed to be out in the middle of nowhere. It was like this, but having watched it more recently in the last few years, I realized they're in the San Fernando Valley.
Oh, yeah.
And so when I was a kid, what I thought of, they were in Texas or somewhere, or just some, completely out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
But in fact, they're in Calabasas or Chatsworth or somewhere.
Well, that's where everybody shot everything for Westerns.
But I mean, that's even where they say they live.
Oh, uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, that's just where they shot, but that's where it's set.
Well, I hope little Luke hung onto the property, because if he did, within a few years, he'd be a very wealthy man.
Oh, boy, yeah. I love stuff like that. I was just on a recent podcast. I was talking with a friend of mine, Tom Holland, a producer that I've known for years and years. And we both have this location thing. I just love location stuff. Mm-hmm. And watching films like Bachelor in Paradise, the Bob Hope film. That is not a good film, and it's not a funny film in any way. I don't like much of anything about it, except that... it's 1962. Mm-hmm. It's shot, I guess, out in Chatsworth or somewhere. And there's just all this great, period feel of it. And at one point, he goes to a supermarket. And, gosh, it must be an Albertsons or something. Uh-huh. I can't remember which one now. But
Thrifty Mart, probably.
Yeah, but so it's a big supermarket.
Yeah,
and it's the scene itself is just, you know, they knock over the cans, they do the regular supermarket shtick. But the valuable thing is that they didn't build a set. They just went inside this real supermarket.
Yeah.
And there it is. There's the way they displayed things. There's the prices. There's the people as they are shopping. And there's something incredibly wonderful to be about that.
It's a documentary without realizing it.
Yeah. And I sometimes think that every movie is, that it reflects its time and place, even when it doesn't even want to.
Mm-hmm.
But especially if there's location stuff. You know, you look at these Keaton things. I love these books that John Bingston has done, showing the location stuff.
Silent
Clowns.
You'll have to come to the next time they do a Laurel and Hardy locations tour of Culver City.
I'd love to do that.
Because there's all manner of wonderful buildings that are still there. And if you bring a book or some 8x10s with you, you can say, well, here's the intersection where they had the big hat fight and hats off, that wonderfully, mythically lost Laurel and Hardy short that we sure wish we still had, but we can go stand right now, as long as traffic isn't about to run us over, we could go stand right there where they were sitting in the midst of that crowd that was ripping each other's hats up, so there it is, because there's the building in the background, or the house for oops, I have a phone call, hang on.
That's why they make the pause button.
Ah, very good. But, yeah, a lot of the Laurel and Hardy locations are still around. The Perfect Day House, if you remember that short. Both the Laurel and Hardy house and the house next door, with the neighbor. They look exactly like they did in 1929.
Where are those?
They're on a street called Vera Avenue. And there's now a freeway overpass behind them. So that's different. But the two precise houses that you see in the film and also the house across the street, they look essentially untouched by time.
Wow.
The Big Business House, which is the one where Laurel and Hardy selling the Christmas tree to Jimmy Finlayson, that still looks very much as it did. And the lady who lives there now is very much aware of the importance of the house and that Laurel and Hardy made this film there. And she, in fact, has a big photograph from Big Business in her living room. So the people coming in see that as the first thing when they walk in. That house, by the way, was owned by a Hal Roach film editor named William Terhune. And so, you know, Hal Roach used to tell this story about how they had scouted this house and the location manager had found it and thought it was a great house and supposedly had made a deal with the people who owned it that they were going to come and do all this damage to it and they'd repay the people. And according to Mr. Roach, they were filming for about 3 days and then the people who owned the house drove up having just come back from vacation and said, "What are you doing to our house?" And, you know, supposedly they had the wrong location. Well, that's a good story. But it's not true at all, because William Terhune did own the house and, in fact, died in that house in 1940. He was only about 41 or 42 years old. I'm not sure what the cause of death was, but he had worked at Hal Roach Studios as an editor until about 1937, and then the last 2 years of his career he worked at MGM and worked on the Marx Brothers film At the Circus, among others, and died in 1940 there in the house, 10281 Dunlear Drive, Cheviot Hills. So, and there are actually 8x10s of him standing. You see him through the window of the house where he's sort of shrugging as if to say, what has happened? What have they done to my house? But obviously they didn't do any substantial damage to the house because here it is all these years later, 80-plus years later, and it's still in just fine shape. So, but anyway, yeah, those locations are wonderful to see, and they're still a surprising number of them in Los Angeles, you know, from old movies. The John Bengtson books are remarkable because, you know, he'll find any last little scrap that's still there, you know, a street lamp or something, you know. Oh, well, now I can, you know, figure out from this was where the chariot race was shot for Ben-Hur, you know. Just amazing some of the detective work that he does. And he doesn't even live out here. He lives in the San Francisco area. And I guess he does a lot of this through computer.
It's amazing. He has an eye for this that I don't possess in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
And I love stuff like that, but I find them when I can. And of course, you know, I've made pilgrimages to certain important places.
Oh, yes.
For me.
You've done your Alamo.
Alamo stuff, and then Fort Zinderneuf out in the desert. Uh-huh. I, you know, made the trip out there and found that site.
Where you found all those spent cartridges
from
the film crew.
That was something. So
that really is, it does feel like archaeology, doesn't it?
It really does, yeah.
I mean, I feel like that enough just going through old documents and, you know, trying to dredge up the history of these long-forgotten people, you know.
Yeah.
But, I mean, when you're actually there on the location and literally finding physical artifacts from an old movie shoot from 80 years before, that, you know, that...
Yeah, we found shoes and just and all sorts of things. It's really amazing.
Yeah.
They've been trying to excavate this the Ten Commandments set up in Guadalupe Dunes for years.
Mm.
And we found more Fort Zinderneuf the first day we were there than they've ever found.
Mm-hmm.
But just the luck of the draw.
Yeah.
It's just what we found. You mentioned Laurel and Hardy. I seem to recall you know a little bit about Laurel and Hardy.
I was going to bring them up when you were talking about the real McCoys because, you know, there's always six degrees of separation. Well, Burt Jordan, who was the film editor on most of the Laurel and Hardy films at Hal Roach Studios, the last thing that he worked on regularly was the Real McCoys series. He told me that. So he had a 50-year career in movies. He was... is one of those great technicians that I got to interview over the years. You know, when I was doing the research for my Laurel and Hardy book, I didn't always do it in the most logical way. I probably should have thought when I was trying to find any Laurel and Hardy film editors, well, go to the editors union and find the directory or find someone to talk to and they'll put you in touch. But, you know, what was I, 19, 20 or something like that? So I just went to all the L.A. area phone books and just looked up, you know, Burt Jordan. And I found five different Burt Jordans in different L.A. area phone books. So I sent a letter out to each one of them saying, I'm doing this research project on Laurel and Hardy. And if you are the Burt Jordan who worked on the Laurel and Hardy films, I'd, you know, love to hear back from you. And I think they all wrote me back. And one of them was this this lovely handwriting said, you know, yes, I am the Burt Jordan that you seek. I am 93 years old and I'm quite hard of hearing, but I would still be very happy to talk with you. And, you know, if you will give me a call, my wife will take the message and we will get a set up a time to get together. And as it turned out, he really wasn't all that hard of hearing. We had a perfectly good conversation. He had a very good memory for being 93 years old. I remember I asked him about how he first got into the film industry, and he said his first job was in 1912 in England at a company called the Lion's Head Film Company.
Wow.
And he said in those days, it was still the days of the patent wars, and there really was not a standardized system as far as the sprocket holes and the type of projector or the type of camera that you would use. So he said you would get this 35 millimeter film, but it did not have any holes in it because they didn't know what process you were using because there were still a lot of different competing processes.
Mm-hmm.
So he said my job was to be in the dark room running this little hole puncher that would punch the sprocket holes into the raw unexposed film stock before they would then go out and shoot the film. And I thought, boy, I'm really talking to history here. that's going pretty far back when your job is punching the holes in the unexposed film stock.
Wow.
You know, wow. So that was pretty interesting. So he was a great interview. I remember we were talking about Fra Diavolo or The Devil's Brother, and that was one where Mr. Roach wanted to put in all this plot footage and romantic footage, and it was originally shown for the press in a print that is 30 minutes longer than the one that we have now.
Hmm.
And it appears that everything they cut out was stuff with the romantic leads. Because I forget, I think it's Lucille Brown is the name of the actress who plays, I think her name is Zerlina. And there's three or four times in the film where she's talking with her beloved and she says, "Oh, Lorenzo," and as she takes a breath to say her next line, there's a rude cut to something else. So obviously that's a scene that got eliminated on the it's on the cutting room floor, because I remember Burt Jordan telling me we had to cut a lot out of that one. And he also told me about doing some preliminary work for Swiss Miss, and this was just after Stan had married Ilyana, who was a very exuberant Russian lady who fancied herself quite a singer. And he said, we would be at Stan's place, Fort Laurel in Canoga Park, and Ileana would put on a record of herself singing, and she would sing a duet with herself. Ooh. And he said, "Oh, it was murder." So, you know, these are the great "you are there" stories that you can only get if you can find those people, you know. I did as good a job as I could of finding those people and getting as many of them interviewed while I still had the opportunity. You know, every once in a while there would be someone that, you know, I had no idea they were still around until I read the obituary. You know, like Dorothy Coburn, who is a supporting player in a lot of the Laurel and Hardy Silence. I would have loved to talk to Dorothy Coburn, and unfortunately, you know, one day reading in the LA Times, there's her obituary, and you just go, "Yeah, you know, she was in Van Nuys, you know." Wow. So there were those little disappointments, but between the Laurel and Hardy people, there were about 65 Laurel and Hardy people that I think I talked to, and Jordan Young and I interviewed, in excess of 100 radio people. And eventually, this has been 20 years in gestation, but eventually we're going to have the radio book that will be the equivalent of The Parades Gone By for silent movies, which is another vanished art form, you know, because I think there really is a parallel with radio and silent film. I think they're both great art forms in and of themselves. I don't think that radio was, you know, the inferior form of television, and I don't think silent films are the inferior form of talking films. I think they have their own merits just by themselves. And, you know, for some reason, we always seem to supplant the old things. We never let them coexist. You know, in England, they still do radio drama all the time on the BBC.
Sure.
You can get them on the Internet. That's never gone away. They still do radio dramas. I don't know why they still don't do them here, because they cost virtually nothing.
Yeah. They do it on rare occasion.
Yeah.
And there are a few that show up on PBS stations and so forth, but there's no sort of concerted effort to do these things. And you would think, yeah, you just put people in a room with a microphone and a good script, and there you go.
A good script and a good sound effects man. And you
theater of the mind.
And you can be on Mars, and it doesn't cost you a dime, you know?
Exactly.
But anyway, yeah, Jordan and I have interviewed over the years people from, you know, Guy Della Chapa, who was the head of the CBS radio network, to sound effects men and actors and actresses and writers and musicians and technicians of all different kinds. So that's all sitting on cassette tape waiting to be digitized. And now, of course, we do have this wonderful software where you can take an audio program and it will spit it out as text for you. So that will be a great help, because in the old days when I had to transcribe interviews manually...
Oh, I need to learn more about this.
Five or six words at a time, it was very slow.
Oh,
you know?
Transcribing interviews is the worst part of being a writer.
Oh, yeah.
For sure.
And, yes, there's a
except for the royalty checks.
There's a program called Dragon Dictate that will... I guess they say it's about 85% accurate. And I said,
wow.
Well, you know what? That's 85% more than what I have it otherwise, you know? So I'll... I'd be very happy to have that. So that's the next project. But, yes, Laurel and Hardy have been an abiding interest of mine since I was, I guess, 5 years old. The first old movies I can remember really being crazy about were the Universal Monster movies. And whereas my bedroom has for many, many years been full of Laurel and Hardy knickknacks, when I was very young, it was Frankenstein and Dracula and the Wolfman. So I don't know why, but those movies never scared me. I always just thought they were just really fun, and I liked that world that's sort of Bavarian, sort of English, sort of American, not really quite anywhere, and also very indistinct about the time frame, you know, because it seems very old world, and yet then somebody will drive up in a 1935 car, you know, so you go, well, yeah, we're not really clear on where or when this is taking place, but it doesn't really matter, you know. A lot of Westerns are like that, too.
Sure.
But anyway, I love those films, and out here in Los Angeles on good old Channel 9 on weekends, they had the Universal Monster Theater, they had the Shirley Temple Theater, they had Charlie Chan Theater. I remember as a very young kid seeing I think it's Charlie Chan at the Opera, because I remember at one point this lady... She says, "Well, dear, get modern. After all, it's 1939. And I remember laughing and going, "It's 1965. What do they know?" You know. So
they're so dumb.
Yeah, they're so dumb. Yeah. I think it was Gail Patrick that said that, actually. anyway, So I was exposed to a lot of old movies back then because they were all over television. And, you know, they had the Charlie Chaplin Comedy Theater, which were terrible step-printed copies of Chaplin movies where they double-printed every other frame so they could ruin the timing. Mm-hmm. And they had very portentous narration by Alexander Scourby and Valentino stock music. So it was like the worst possible way to present Charlie Chaplin. And yet, I remember seeing, you know, his Jitney Elopement and things like that and thinking, hey, these are pretty funny, you know, when I was a little kid. But the movie that changed my life was The Golden Age of Comedy, the Robert Youngson compilation.
Yeah.
Channel 9 used to have the Million Dollar Theater, and they would show the same film for a solid week every night at 7:30. And they must have had a fairly small film library because they would show one film every weeknight. And I must have caught it on Sunday or Monday because I know I watched it several times that week. And, you know, by the end of that week, I was just sworn to the faith. You know, I had fallen in love with that whole, not just the style of movie making, but that time and that place. And I realized that this was 25 miles up the freeway, you know, even when I was 5 years old, I realized, you know, oh, this is Culver City. You know, I've been there. I remember being there, you know. So I knew that when they were out shooting on location, these were real buildings, and there was some connection still there to that, what seemed to be so long ago. But, of course, this is 1965, so it's only roughly 40 years from when those films were being made, you know.
Okay, we'll put that on pause until next week, and I hope you'll come back for part two of my conversation with Randy Skredvet. That's when we start getting more into Laurel and Hardy, which you would have thought that that's where we would have started off, but we didn't. We just sort of meandered, and there you go. Randy knows a lot about Laurel and Hardy and a lot about the other great comics, and knew many of them. So we're going to talk about all that stuff next week, and I hope you'll come back. In the meantime, I hope you'll help the commentary track stay alive, and you can do that in several different ways. One, you can go to iTunes and subscribe to the commentary track, and while you're there, you can give me a high rating and a nice review. If you feel like giving me a bad review, just think twice about it and then leave iTunes and consider that you've done a good deed by saying nothing. You could also go to the commentary track website. That's thecommentarytrack.com, and listen to each episode one at a time. All of the previous episodes are downloaded there, and we have my talks with Kevin Brownlow and Carl Davis and Rudy Belmer and many others. They'll always be there, so you can go there and listen to them whenever you feel like it. Right there on the front page of the website is a PayPal link, and if you want to just give me a contribution to help me keep the thing going, you can just push that button and it'll tell you how to do that, and I would be most appreciative. The other way that is not out-and-out charity is that you can use the Amazon links to check out the books and videos and CDs and so forth from every one of my guests. Just go on each one of their pages, click on the View Full Details link, and when it takes you to a picture of them and a little bit about them, and then there will be Amazon links to much of their work. If you go through my site and click on these links, when you buy them, you will not pay one penny more than you would otherwise, but Amazon will give me a little bit back, and many, many, many little bits add up to a lot of bits. So I hope that you will consider doing that. I also have on my page, on the website, a page of my books and a page of my videos that I've been associated with. In terms of the books, there are Amazon links, but there are also several of my books that I have copies of. And if you want to get autographed copies, you can simply hit the PayPal link for those. Leave me a note about how you would like me to deface your property. Then I will send it right out from here. If I don't have extra copies, then I have an Amazon link. And you can do it, and I will just get back my little kickback as for being an Amazon associate, and that would be swell, too. So I urge you to do any or all of those things, and more important, more to the point, I urge you to come back next week for another episode of the Commentary Track, and for every week thereafter, where we'll have great filmmakers and film historians and archivists and all sorts of cool, groovy people to talk movies with. So we'll see you next week. And don't worry, we'll fix it in post.